Judiciary Committee for Tuesday, March 13th. Committee members, we're going to be proceeding through the agenda in the order in which you see it printed, with a couple of work sessions and then going on to public hearings on four bills. The first of those work sessions is House Bill 2318. I will open a work session on House Bill 2318. Council Plummer, could you remind us what was happening with this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2318, originally heard at a public hearing February 1st. The measure makes the time period for settlement 60 days from the end of the mediation session before the appeal is assigned to a tax magistrate.
Committee members, there was were some concerns raised about this bill that might have led to amendments, but in fact, after discussions, I understand that no amendments were urged, and so the bill, as it was heard by us back in early February, is back before us. And it was just a pretty technical bill, just relating to the timing by which mediation of tax disputes can occur. Is there any discussion of the bill? And do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2318 to the floor with a due pass and be put on the consent calendar.
Representative Barker has moved House Bill 2318 to the floor with a due pass recommendation for placement on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Barker. Aye.
House Bill 2318 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be placed on the consent calendar. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2318 and open a work session on House Bill 2320. Council Plummer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We heard House Bill 2320 on February 1st as well. The measure authorizes the State Court Administrator to enter into intergovernmental agreements with the U.S. Financial Management Service and the IRS for the purpose of offsetting tax refunds against debtors' liquidated and delinquent accounts to the state courts. It also requires the Oregon Lottery Commission to notify the State Court Administrator when a winner whose prize exceeds $600 is delinquent in paying delinquent accounts to the state courts. The proposed Dash 1 amendment prioritizes delinquent child support obligations over the payment of the delinquent judicial accounts. And this bill also has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Committee members, you see the Dash 1 amendments in front of you. As well as you having the fiscal impact statement that shows some outlay to implement the measure, although I would urge you to note that in the fiscal analysis, the projections of what will be collected to cover delinquent obligations far exceeds the outlays here that are being projected for to implement the measure. Let's see that the Judicial Department has estimate. Is this the estimate here, the $8.3
million? No, that's how much they collect each year.
I'm not sure we see a figure for the lottery figure. I see that, which is a projection that they'll generate nearly $375,000 a biennium by the expenditure on that implementation. And I think there's a Council Plummer, did I understand that there's federal legislation necessary in order to be able to implement the federal recovery from IRS refunds?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. There's currently no companion statute to implement this on the federal level, but it is in the pipeline. It is being discussed this session.
Okay. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just noticing on this report on page 2, the second full paragraph, due to the lack of functionality in OJD's legacy computer system, they are unable to interface with the federal system to automate the monitoring and updating of case balances. And just want to point out that just as recently as yesterday, we had another instance where the Justice Department's computer system, Judicial Department's computer system, wasn't able to do what it needs to do. And I understand that we had testimony that they're working on that, but at some point, I think that we're spending a lot of money when we shouldn't be investing in a better computer system for the Judicial Department, which may save money in the long run, because here we are talking about additional staff necessary to manually submit and update the case balances because their computer system isn't able to do that. So let's just keep that in mind.
It's a very good comment, and it's something that perhaps our colleagues on the Ways and Means Committee should consider when the bill comes before them. Any further discussion? Do I hear a motion on the dash one amendments then?
Mr. Chairman, the dash one amendments in the House Bill 2320.
Representative Barker moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 2320. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Then the dash one amendments are in the bill. Is there a motion on the main bill, which would be a motion to for due pass and referral to the Ways and Means Committee by prior reference?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2320 to the floor with a due pass with referral to through Ways and Means.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2320 from the committee with the due pass recommendation for referral to the Ways and Means Committee by prior reference. Is there any discussion of the motion?
Chair.
Representative Kump.
Back to the bigger question, and I don't know if this is the appropriate time, but since this is going to go to Ways and Means, that's why I'm asking it. Is there a way to support the Department of Justice in a faster model to get the technology? I mean, to hear yesterday again that we'd have something in place in 5 years. That's like flying to the moon on a, in 1960. It just seems like such a distance away that technology moves so fast. I mean, in 45 days, I mean, you can update your PDA. And I don't know. Like I say, this may not be the place, but I think we possibly have a committee have a responsibility to discuss that further at some time.
A point well taken, Representative, and I would say I'm not sure that our committee is the right setting
right,
for it.
Right, I don't
but,
either.
But it is troublesome that functions that happen so efficiently and pervasively in other parts of the economy seem such a struggle
right.
when they're undertaken by state agencies. So.
I wasn't going to go that far.
It may well be because of decisions that are made in this
possible arena.
Branch of our government to not support them with given the resources that are provided in those other.
Because that's my question. What is our responsibility, or do we have responsibility to support them in a better way?
Yeah. Any further discussion,
Mr. Chair?
Representative Cameron.
Yeah, I just want to clarify, because it has been a while since we've seen this bill, and to follow up on Representative Bonamici's point, is this this bill will allow them to do this for the OJD for the state issue, and I'm just reading the fiscal impact on this page, and it says it's going to cost them $39,500 the first year. To collect this money, but then the next paragraph goes on to talk about a $600,000 to $700,000 biennium cost, and I think that is to do the federal issue. And I'm just a little bit confused. I'm sure it's clear. I'm just a little confused on this, and I'm sure we'll see this in Ways and Means. What are we really talking about adding here? Are we talking about adding the $39,000, or are we talking about adding the $600,000 to collect a lot less money than that? Is there anybody here that can clarify that?
I'm looking for the reference to the $600,000 figure.
Oh, okay. It's on page 2 of the fiscal analysis. Proposed legislation on page 2, the second paragraph. This bill talks about the state. I'm assuming that's how much they're forecasting they'll generate, and what it's going to cost. And then the next paragraph, it says due to lack of functionality, and I'm a little unclear about
last sentence.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to confess, I don't follow all the figures myself, and I guess the question is whether we should limit our focus as a policy committee to the policies that are involved in this bill, which is that we should enter into an arrangement with the federal government to collect from IRS funds and collect from lottery winnings, and then leave the number, more precise number crunching, to Ways and Means, or should we try to penetrate these numbers further? And if so, we probably need somebody from the Judicial Department to explain this to us in more detail.
Just a follow-up, if I may, to that comment. And that's, I understand that we're looking at the policy here, but if this policy, in fact, is going to cost us $633,000 to collect, and $374,000, I have a problem with that policy. I need that clear, because I think I'm wrong in that analysis I just made there, but I just somehow I'm not seeing where.
I
see what I'm saying?
Kingsley Click is in the room. Kingsley, could you come forward and Ms. Click and help us understand the numbers we're seeing here?
Thank you. For the record, Kingsley Click, State Court Administrator. I'll try. There are two parts to the bill, Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron. The part dealing with the lottery, there was $39,000 in costs. That included reprogramming of the lotteries, special interface, and then some of their staff costs, which would continue on for the following biennium, about $22,000 for the subsequent biennium, just for their staff costs, and that would be paid out of the other funds revenues from the collections account. Then the $600,000 in costs you're alluding to had to do with the federal tax offset, and that was the estimate for six limited duration positions until there was a more functional automated system, and that's also premised on the federal law passing. And if it passes this year, there's probably going to be another year before it'd be up and running. I'm not sure what their effective date would be, so it could be pretty close to having a more automated way to do it by the time it's in place. But we were estimating if we had to do it manually, this is what it would cost and be out of the collections account. But the revenues from the federal tax offset were in the multi-millions. I believe it was, trying to find where that was. I believe it was about, I want to say $36 million, but just looking if we had put that, roughly $58 million was what we were estimating should the federal tax offset.
Where is that, Mr. Chair?
The federal tax offset revenue was in our testimony. I have our fiscal impact statement that we sent down there. Let me just check though. If they made any kind of, they may not have made in LFOs. They said this is dependent upon gaining federal and statutory authority, so the biennium's results will be dependent on timing of gaining this authority. So they did not, in theirs, make an estimate on that. They only made an estimate on the lottery part. But I'd be happy to provide any background material on the other estimate for the committee, if you'd like.
Thank you. I found it.
Okay. Ms. Click, let me understand a little more precisely how these fiscal impacts, how they time in with the expenditures or the expected revenue that will come in. What I'm understanding, I think, is that we'll have these costs that are of nearly $40,000 and then another $22,000 in the next two biennia, and that that's for the lottery piece of the bill, and that we expect to collect from those lottery winnings $375,000 per biennium. So one way of looking at it is that that piece would cost in the neighborhood of $30,000 a biennium in order to collect $375,000. And then with respect to the federal tax refund piece, the costs of manually doing this work would be rather substantial, $600,000 or $800,000 per biennium, but that that depends on there being federal legislation to authorize this to happen in addition to this state legislation. So if while we're waiting for that federal legislation, and if it were not to occur, would these costs be incurred, the $600,000 or $800,000?
Chair McPherson, they would not. They would be premised on the authority being there and the department and the Department of Revenue then putting together the interface to intercept those funds. So they can't, they would not be in place until there was a legislation in place to capture the funds.
So would it be fair to characterize what the federal tax refund piece of this bill as authorizing something to happen that may not happen until and unless the federal government, the Congress, enacts parallel legislation? And at that point, then the effect of this bill would be to commit us to expenditures of $600,000 or $800,000 per biennium, with the expectation that we would then collect some millions. Well, the current amount collected from state tax refunds is $8.3 million, and so I'm assuming federal income taxes being higher than state income taxes, it would be some increment above that. Is that a fair expectation?
Yes, Chair McPherson, they were estimating potentially $58 million of uncollected debt obligations of biennium could be collected with the federal tax offset.
Any further questions or discussion? Thank you, Ms. Glick. So, committee, we have a motion before us, which is to move House Bill 2320 as amended with a due pass recommendation for referral to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any further discussion? If not, then the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
Aye. House Bill 2320 as amended moves with a due pass recommendation to the Committee on Ways and Means. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2320 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2826. Council Kalmanson and Representative Reed, why don't you position yourself at the witness table?
Sure.
Going to have a little, and gentlemen, we'll bring you up in a moment after we have a little introductory commentary here. Council Kalmanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2826 establishes that a corporation may adopt a provision in its articles of incorporation that authorizes or directs the corporation to conduct its business in an environmentally and socially responsible manner.
And one of the chief sponsors of the bill, Representative Reed, is before us. Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am one of the chief sponsors with our chair, and I would not purport to give you a long presentation on the substance of this bill, but merely to say something about its intent and ask for your support. I think it's important to remember the experience of a lot of businesses and founders who may feel limited in their ability to consider social and environmental considerations as they make business decisions because of the way our structure is requiring directors to make the their fiduciary responsibility primary. And this bill doesn't change that, except to say that at the beginning of a business, when it's established, it gives the founders an option to include a statement about their intent to operate in an environmentally and socially responsible manner. Still gives those folks the freedom to define that as they will, and to operate as they would like, but an opportunity to say from the beginning, this is something about who we are and how we want to operate. I think those are they're real opportunities in Oregon and in the country for environmentally and socially responsible businesses, and we should do all we can to support the establishment and good operation of those businesses. So appreciate your hearing the bill, and hope for your support.
Any questions for Representative Reed? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Now, Jim Kennedy and Jeff Wolfstone. Gentlemen, I'll let you present in whichever order you prefer, but do begin by identifying yourselves for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Kennedy, James M. Kennedy. I'm a partner in the Portland law firm of Kennedy & Kennedy, LLP. My practice focuses on business law, and in my over 30 years of practice, I have served on the drafting committees of the Oregon Business Corporation Act, the Oregon Revised Partnership Act, and the Oregon Uniform Limited Partnership Act. House Bill 2826 amends ORS 60.047 subsection 2 by permitting the Articles of Incorporation of an Oregon corporation to include, quote, a provision authorizing or directing the corporation to conduct the business of the corporation in a manner that is environmentally and socially responsible. In understanding the need for this legislation, it's important to have some background information. First, what is the existing law? I think the best summary of the existing law is set forth in the American Law Institute's Principles of Corporate Governance, which in section 2.01b states that even if corporate profit and shareholder gain are not thereby enhanced, the corporation in the conduct of its business may take into account ethical considerations that are reasonably regarded as appropriate to the responsible conduct of the business. Now, this ALI summary of the existing law is not binding on the Oregon courts. And it's important to keep that in mind, but it is a very good restatement of what existing law is. In understanding this legislation, it's also important to understand the business judgment rule, because that explains the legal context in which decisions are made by corporate boards. In making business decisions, corporate directors rely on the business judgment rule, which has been established by the case law. The business judgment rule really is not a substantive standard of director conduct. It is instead a standard of judicial review. And if the business judgment rule applies, courts are not willing to second-guess board decisions, not displace those decisions, because an appropriate process has been utilized in making the decision. The requirements for the business judgment rule are really three. First, the decision needs to be made by disinterested directors. Secondly, there needs to be reasonable information and diligence used in making the business decision. And third, there has to be a good faith belief that the business decision is in the best interest of the corporation. Once these three requirements are satisfied, the decision stands, and the courts will not displace it with their own judgments. So the business judgment rule is very important to corporate boards in making decisions, and particularly in the area of making decisions about environmentally and socially responsible conduct, where there may be some sacrifice of short-term or long-term profits. If the business judgment rule protects directors, then the obvious question is, why do we need this legislation? And the answer is that the business judgment rule is not particularly well defined in Oregon because of the lack of case law. In other states, the business judgment rule, the parameters of it are very well defined because there are many appellate decisions that consider the business judgment rule. As a result, corporate boards really don't have the confidence in Oregon, that is the boards of Oregon corporations, that the business judgment rule will protect them. And when you couple this with academic arguments and judicial dicta regarding shareholder primacy, which is really this overarching fiduciary duty that's owed to shareholders to maximize shareholder gain, corporate boards can become chilled, and particularly when you're dealing with the potential sacrifice of profits as it relates to environmentally and socially responsible business conduct. So this legislation is necessary to increase the confidence of corporate boards in making some of these difficult business decisions. Will this legislation be a license for corporate boards and management to devote unreasonably large corporate resources to programs that they deem to be in the public interest? I think the answer is no, because corporations remain subject to market forces such as takeovers, price competition, the need for corporate financing, and also because corporate boards are subject to removal by the shareholders. This bill is intended to permit corporate boards to adopt and implement environmentally and socially responsible policies if they are approved by the shareholders and if they are placed in the articles of incorporation. So really, this bill recognizes shareholder democracy. In essence, it creates a contract between the corporation and the shareholders regarding the manner in which environmentally and socially responsible conduct will be conducted by the corporation. And in this way, by articulating these policies in the articles, it really creates transparency and aligns shareholder objectives. So for all of these reasons, I would urge you to approve this bill. In closing, I just want to briefly note that the failure of a corporation to include these types of provisions in their articles should not be deemed to be a limit on their right under existing law to engage in socially and environmentally responsible conduct where there is some sacrifice of profitability. That concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Kennedy, for your excellent testimony. The staff measure summary that we have says that courts in other jurisdictions have interpreted the business judgment rule as requiring corporations to act in a manner that maximizes corporate profits. And in your testimony, you mentioned a positive Oregon case law on the business judgment rule. Are you aware of any trends in this area from other jurisdictions? Are courts trending to say that the business judgment rule requires maximization of profits, or are the cases in fact trending the other way, saying this type of socially responsible, environmentally responsible decision making is preferred or permitted?
I think there are lots of cases under the business judgment rule that really indicate that these types of decisions are permissible. However, there are some cases to the contrary. And really what it comes down to, in terms of my summary of the business judgment rule, I talked about the third element, the good faith belief that the decision is in the best interest of the corporation. That allows some academic arguments regarding the fact that the best interests of the corporations are to increase shareholder gain. And the difficulty the courts have, if they adopt that view, is how do you measure it? I mean, in looking at this conduct, there are clearly intangible benefits to the corporation. Is there going to be long-term shareholder gain or not? And it's almost impossible to measure. And with respect to some of the decisions, there may be almost a myth that's created of merely being able to ascribe this type of conduct to some sort of long-term shareholder gain, however minimal. So I think you'll find a variety of decisions, but I think there are lots of decisions under the business judgment rule that would endorse this type of conduct. But because there are countervailing positions that exist in the case law, that creates a chilling effect on corporate boards.
Thank you.
Senator Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Environmentally and socially responsible manner. How are you going to, whose vision or opinion as to what is environmentally and socially responsible or acceptable? Who makes that call? I mean, that could be 10 people on a board have a different vision. Different stockholders could have a different vision. There's a publication put out, I think it's by Dr. Paul Adams, Science 101, that talks about the agendas of the environmental community and how you measure those and the criteria, and how difficult it is to take personal opinion out of the environmental issues. And I don't disagree with anyone. You know, I operate my tree farm in an environmental sound manner. I was national tree farmer for the whole United States by doing that. But to tell somebody what is socially acceptable, that's going to change with time. I don't know how you measure the gain or loss before you make the decision to do some of these things. And you talked about the stockholders could vote on it. Could a stockholder then challenge the corporate board decision if they feel the policy cost him profits that weren't necessarily producing a social or environmental responsible benefit?
Well, let me take your questions in the order that you raised them. First of all, keep in mind that this is really just a grant of authority to corporations to, in essence, enter into this contract that I referred to between the corporation and the shareholder. So the design of the bill is really for there to be a very broad and general authority given to the corporation to enter into these so-called contracts with the shareholders. And really what will govern the corporation's conduct is what is placed in the Articles of Incorporation. And with respect to the next witness, he will talk in general about what the corporation he is associated with has done in terms of their Articles of Incorporation. The second question is, what impact does it have on shareholders who disagree? There is nothing in this bill that deals with that changes the rights of dissenting shareholders, those shareholders who disagree with the actions that have been taken. And to the extent that value is being expropriated from those shareholders, they would have any cause of action that they have currently regarding changes in the Articles of Incorporation. So there is no intention to change their rights under this bill.
If there are no further questions, why don't we hear from Mr. Wolfstone, and then we can return to questions.
Okay. Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2826. My name is Jeffrey C. Wolfstone. I'm a partner in the Portland law firm of Lane Powell PC, and I'm also currently serving as general counsel of an outdoor apparel company based in Portland called Now Inc. NAU. That's how it's spelled. I, in the past, served as chair of the drafting committee for the Oregon Nonprofit Corporation Act. I'm going to focus my testimony, and I'm going to try and be very brief. I'm not going to go through all the moving parts of the written testimony, but just try to provide this as an example. This, with respect to the company Now, as an example of a business corporation that's elected to expressly authorize or require consideration of environmental and social responsibility. The statement of the company's mission is in the material, and I won't read it. I'm just going to touch on a couple of examples of things that the company has included in its corporate charter. The company's charter indicates that it will endeavor to conduct all aspects of its business in an environmentally and socially responsible manner, and there are a number of pieces of it also in the written testimony that you can read in more detail. Second, in exercising their power and discharging their duties, the company's directors and officers are authorized to take into consideration and balance the interests of the environment, human rights, public health or safety, the communities in which the company operates, and the dignity of its employees. Third, the company must have in place a program requiring that 5% of the purchase price of goods and services sold be contributed to a charitable organization. And I'd submit that this is a pretty radical departure for most companies. There are a few companies out there that do similar things, and increasingly you'll see a lot of companies are adopting corporate giving programs. And to this end, this company has selected several international, regional, and local partners for change that will receive donations as designated by customers at the point of purchase. Fourth, the company will pay its U.S. employees no less than 1.5 times the U.S. federal minimum wage and will compensate non-U.S.-based employees in a fair and reasonable manner. Fifth, domestic partners, same or opposite sex, will be eligible to receive benefits to the same extent as spouses. And finally, no officer of the company will be paid a cash salary exclusive of bonus and equity-based comp more than 12 times the compensation paid to the lowest paid full-time employee based in the U.S. And these rules are built into the company's charter and can be changed only with a 75% shareholder vote. And so I just provide this as an illustration. Obviously, this isn't a roadmap for other companies. It's one example that may be, compared to a lot of companies, pretty far out there. But the concept in the statute, I think, as we see, is that by opting in to the provision that is contained in this amendment, a company can really write its own rules. And I would guess that other companies, if they chose to do that, would take one piece or another piece or write something really to their own liking, and it would become part of the company's charter. And I think in this, at this time, as this state has set for itself an ambitious agenda as a leader in promoting environmental sustainability, this modest amendment is something that may encourage other private companies to take an enlightened view of their role and responsibility. So thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Representative Barker.
Thank you. So a company could adopt this without actually doing it if they just wanted to have this in there. I mean, if Halliburton had decided to come to Oregon instead of Dubai, they could say we're socially responsible and environmentally responsible. They could have this and be the same way they are today, and it wouldn't make any difference. I mean, they wouldn't be required to do anything by having this in their statement.
They would be entitled, if they chose to opt in, to write their own rules.
Okay. And so their rules could be like oil exploration is really the environmentally sound thing to do, and whatever they is their vision of what environmentally sound and socially appropriate. Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Gentlemen, I'll throw this out to both of you. The effect of putting this into the articles of incorporation is, in effect, to put the world on notice, because it's a public document about that is one of the considerations that the corporate management will be applying. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes.
Yes, that is correct.
And without this legislation, then subject to obviously how the business judgment rule would be applied in Oregon courts, there would be the risk that a corporate board of directors that took into account social and environmental issues interpreted however it chose to interpret them, but if it took that into consideration and didn't maximize the profit that to the shareholders, could be subject to challenge, that is to a claim by shareholders that they had misused corporate assets. Is that a fair understanding?
Chairman McPherson, I'm not sure I quite understand your question.
Okay, let me phrase it again. Make sure I've got my mind wrapped around this correctly. If we don't have this bill, then if a board of directors took into account the social and environmental considerations,
shareholders of the corporation could challenge them for in their decision making, perhaps make a claim against them for personal liability for having misapplied corporate assets because they didn't pursue just maximizing the return to the shareholders.
That is correct. This bill really does allow the corporation to establish expectations which it shares with its shareholders in terms of this conduct. So it provides more comfort to the board in terms of making these difficult decisions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Representative Krieger.
The environmental part of it, aren't all corporations already required to follow all state and federal environmental laws to meet certain standards?
Yes, they are. So, but there are a lot of the question is corporations are required to comply with applicable law. The question is in the environmental area, do you want to go further than what the minimum requirement is under existing law? I mean, Representative Krieger, you had indicated you're a tree farmer. I'm also a tree farmer, and one of the questions that confronts us as tree farmers is, do we comply only with the Oregon Forest Practices Act, or do we decide to adopt, for example, more sustainable forestry practices? I mean, there's a wide range of decisions in managing our forests that we can make with respect to our decisions, and this allows a corporation to make a more environmentally friendly decision than the minimum amount that's required under federal environmental laws or state forestry laws.
I could also give an example in a consumer products company setting. There may not be very many environmental laws that directly affect the operation of the company, but the company, for example, may decide that in producing materials, the company will look at the sourcing of the materials and consider whether, for example, it may want to use fewer oil-based products. In the case of this company that I'm referring to as an example, the company is sourcing from one of its products from polylactic acid, which is a byproduct of corn, and it reduces the use of oil. That would be an example where legally it's not required, but the company's decided to do it because it thinks that it's more environmentally responsible to do that.
Senator Forrester, do you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I understand this language, this is permissive. Articles of incorporation may set forth these types of things. So in the context of the determinations that a corporation might make, cannot, without this legislation, as your now corporation has done, make these determinations and include them in their articles and within their corporate philosophy?
The answer is yes. It can be done today even without the statute, but the statute would provide greater certainty to the board and management of the company.
Subject
if the
to
company
the
were to
approval
opt in.
To shareholders, is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you. Follow up?
You may.
And Mr. Wolfstone, in your testimony on page 2, talking about the remuneration for U.S. employees and then non-U.S.-based employees, indicating that that determination is based upon a fair and just manner. So for non-U.S. employees, what's the criteria to determine fair and just?
Well, the company has adopted a, in this particular example you're referring to, the company has adopted a set of standards looking at what looking at the living standards in the country, has done research on it, has also engaged an auditing firm that looks at the practices of the various factories where goods are made to determine whether they are, according to benchmarks that exist among companies that are producing products in those markets, are viewed as fair and reasonable. It's a judgment call. There is no absolute standard. They're probably paying the workers more than, in many cases, almost any other job they might be able to get. But they're trying to set a standard.
Thank you. And a question perhaps for either of the chief sponsors. I'm curious about the need to include an emergency provision for this particular bill, since it is a permissive issue.
Representative Flores, I'd have to say I had not paid attention to the fact that there is an emergency clause.
I do see it if it's there.
And, gentlemen, I'm going to put that out to our witnesses. Is there a particular reason why this bill would need an emergency clause or something special in terms of timing as compared to the end of the year, which is when it would take effect otherwise?
Not that we're aware of.
Mr. Chair, and I would just note that I would have some exception to including an emergency provision for this type of bill.
I don't recall even when the discussions that I'd had with the those who were preparing the bill before, particularly noting an emergency clause. So I think that it may be a good point about that piece. Any other questions for our witnesses? Thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Teenson, did you you're right signed up? Did you want to present? Okay. Okay, very good. Okay, very good. Well, I think in view of the point about the emergency clause, I think it's a good point. I think we will not take action on House Bill 2826 today. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2826 and move us to a public hearing on the next bill, which is Senate Bill 304. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 304. We have Council Kalmanson. Tell us what this bill is doing.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. Senate Bill 304 inserts a definition of securities account into the definitional section of the statute that adopts revised Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code. Revised Article 9 deals with secured transactions, and there's a definition section which doesn't define securities account. However, the Oregon statute that adopts Article 8 of the Uniform Commercial Code does have a definition of securities account. All this bill does is essentially incorporate by reference the definition of securities account that's in Oregon's Article 8 into Oregon's revised Article 9.
Thank you, Council. We have Melissa Briggs from the State Bar Debtor-Creditor section here. Ms. Briggs.
Good morning, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Melissa Briggs. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Debtor-Creditor Section Legislation Committee. Thank you for this opportunity to comment on Senate Bill 304. My testimony will be brief, as this bill merely seeks to make a technical correction. Senate Bill 304 addresses an inadvertent omission from the prior bill. In 2001, the legislature adopted revised Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code with certain non-uniform changes as ORS Chapter 79. Revised Article 9 governs personal property secured transactions, for example, a security interest in equipment or inventory to secure a loan. Revised Article 9, Section 102, contains definitions and also incorporates into Revised Article 9 definitions from other UCC articles, including the definition of securities account from Article 8 of the Uniform Commercial Code. However, when the legislature adopted Revised Article 9 in 2001, the definition of securities account was inadvertently left out of Chapter 79. There is no reason why the legislature would have intended to delete that reference from Chapter 79, because securities account is used in many places in Chapter 79. Senate Bill 304 makes a technical correction to remedy this omission. The bill would solve this problem by inserting into ORS Chapter 79 a reference to the definition of securities account in ORS Chapter 78. Doing so would prevent the need for litigation over the meaning of securities account in revised Article 9. I urge this committee to move this bill to the full House with a due pass recommendation. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any question for this, questions for Ms. Briggs? Thank you, Ms. Briggs. Why don't you just stay put there while we close the public hearing, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 304. Committee, this is like just a technical kind of change in definitions that probably doesn't raise any policy issues, but I'd ask Ms. Briggs to stay at the witness table in case there were any questions you had at this point while we get ready to work on the bill. Representative Cameron.
Well, I guess I did have a question during the public hearing. A UCC filing, as I understand it, is on the assets of a business that probably is borrowed from money from a bank, is what I'm familiar with. So typically there has to be a notice when you go to sell those assets. You have to talk to the bank or somehow formally notify them. What about a securities account when you go to buy and sell the securities within that account? How do you notify the bank on what you're doing there? Maybe I'm off base here.
Ms. Briggs, if you could comment now, that would be helpful.
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, I actually may be just as uninformed as you are, but I assume that there's a filing as well. I know to perfect the interest, you have to file it to attach it, so I would assume that there's a filing that takes place, same as with a regular security interest.
Representative Cameron, do you have further questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, before we go forward on this bill, I think we need to answer that question because, it's one thing to have big assets and have UCC filings against those, but to have a securities account in a business and do some daily trading or if that's what we're talking about here, we're talking about an account that a business might own that owns stocks or owns interest in another company.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative
Bonamici. I'm not even going to attempt to answer the substance of Representative Cameron's question. In fact, I was tempted to ask Ms. Briggs if there's still the common understanding in law school that classes on UCC really is what happens when you get your grade. But I don't think that this bill addresses any of the substance. I think it just adds a definition. So I don't think it even addresses Representative Cameron's concerns about whether or not there's a filing. I think it just adds a definition of securities account. It doesn't change how anything's done or the policy. It just adds a definition. That's my understanding.
That's right. And just to add to that, and the definition it's adding already exists in another UCC part of Oregon law. It's just incorporating that definition into Article 9. So Article 9 uses the word securities account but doesn't define it. And it's just saying when we say securities account, we mean it in the same way we meant it in this other statute. So, but it's not changing any. There's nothing substantive going on.
And Mr. Chair, in essence, 9 pages of current statute adding on page 9, line 18, the reference to securities account and the statutory site.
That's correct.
Okay. Now this may take the prize for the amount of repeated text in order to make one change.
Okay.
Any further questions? Any concern about this point, Mr. Cameron?
No.
Okay. So, if there's no further discussion, do I hear a motion on Senate Bill 304?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 304 to the floor with a due pass and put on a consent calendar.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 304 to the floor with a due pass recommendation for placement on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Warren.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative
Trigger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wilson.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. Senate Bill 304 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation for placement on the consent calendar. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 304. Thank you, Ms. Briggs. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 305.
Council Cummins.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 305 concerns the ability of holders of testamentary powers of appointment to bind persons whose interests are subject to the powers of appointment. What that means is if you're an individual who holds a general testamentary power of appointment, that means that you are somebody who will be giving a beneficiary of a trust who will be giving an interest to other individuals at some future date. A general holder is somebody who is not limited in who they will be giving that interest to. The statute as written right now, ORS 130.105, allows holders of these interests to bind the future interest holders. And what this does is that it allows a trustee to give notice to just the holder, and that binds everybody else. SB 305 takes out the word general from ORS 130.105. And essentially what that does is it allows limited holders of testamentary powers of appointment. A limited holder, as the name implies, limits to whom the holder can give the interest in the future. So it would have the same effect. It would allow a trustee to give notice to just the holder of the power of appointment, and that would bind the future interest holders. And so it's complicated, but I'll let the person testify, but it's a sort of a technical change to the trustee law, the Oregon Uniform Trust Code.
We have Jonathan Levy here from the Oregon State Bar Estate Planning and Administration Section.
Chair McPherson, committee members, I'm Jonathan Levy. I'm chair-elect of the Estate Planning and Administration Section. I'm an estate planning lawyer in private practice in Portland, and I represent both trustees and beneficiaries. This is a technical correction to the Uniform Trust Code, which was passed into law in the last session. And I believe that this amendment would save Oregonians money because it would avoid some unnecessary legal proceedings and fees to lawyers such as me. It could permit the use of agreements with less resort to court. Now, what I'd like to go over a little bit about the concept of representation, because some of this material is hard to understand, at least for me, in the abstract, and I think I can put it in a little bit more concrete terms. There are certain kinds of business with trusts that often can be or should be resolved by agreement rather than going to court, such as approving the change of trustee, modifying the trust where it's appropriate, reviewing and approving the actions of an outgoing retiring trustee. And sometimes it's hard to have these agreements because there are many beneficiaries, there are minor beneficiaries, the beneficiaries have not yet been determined. So the Uniform Trust Code has adopted various rules to permit one person to represent all these other people in signing and approving and getting notices, as long as the representatives' interests are consistent with the interests of the people who are being represented. One of the types of representatives that the current statute permits is the holder of a general power of appointment. And let me put that in a specific example because I think it's easier to understand. Let's say that I leave my money to my wife, and I say she inherits it all in a trust, and at her death, she can redirect where it goes through her will, and she can redirect it to anyone she wants in the whole world. That's the general power of appointment. And with that kind of direction, if there's going to be a change to the trust, my wife could represent anyone who could potentially take based on her direction, and it would simplify the administration. But let's say that I had something a little bit different, a limited power of appointment where I left my money to my wife, and I said, she can direct where it goes, but it has to go to someone who is one of our descendants or to a charity. So I'm limiting her to our descendants or a charity. That's a limited power of appointment. And under the current law, my wife couldn't represent all of those people if there's some business that the trust needs to handle, because the statute doesn't provide for that kind of representation. I believe there is no good reason to distinguish limited and general powers of appointment. I think that the holder of a limited power of appointment ought to be able to represent the potential recipients that she could designate, and in that way avoid unnecessary court proceedings, avoid unnecessary legal fees. And for that reason, I ask that the committee recommend due pass for this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Levy, I'm assuming the classic situation that you're addressing would be a case where one gives one's spouse a power of appointment to decide the allocation of resources among the children. I mean, obviously there could be other situations, but that would be the classic case where this would come up, right?
Mr. Chair, that's trust for a spouse is a common example. Another common example is trust for children, where the person leaving the money does not want the child to have the money directly, but keep it in a lifelong trust, but then allow the child to decide where the money goes, whether it's to the whole world or to a more limited class.
But in this bill would deal with a case where it's a more limited class, that is, where it's not, because it's the whole world, then it's a general power of appointment, and then this bill wouldn't be necessary. But if it's any limitation on that, the range of those other beneficiaries, then the notice requirement isn't sufficient if given to that person holding the power, correct?
That's right, Mr. Chair. The bill extends the ability to represent others to someone who holds a limited power of appointment, who can only sprinkle the money among a defined class of people.
Okay. I'm having a little hesitation here. But so, for example, I know somebody who's remarried, and so he has some assets, family assets, which he's inherited. And he says, I want my three sons to have that money. As long as my wife still lives, she can keep the house, she can live here and all that. But the assets are going to my kids, not to hers. Would that fit into this kind of a...
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, that's a fairly common estate planning arrangement you have just described, but it doesn't apply to this bill, because the person who's leaving the money is not giving the wife the ability to redirect it. It's already being set in concrete from the get-go.
Okay, thank you. I think I see.
This is a pretty technical little point here in this bill, Committee. Any further questions about for Mr. Levy? Thank you, Mr. Levy. If you could, as I did before, if you could remain at the witness table here while I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 305 and open a work session on Senate Bill 305. I think that it's just a question of who has to be notified with respect to actions on a trust and the difference between a general and limited power appointment. Comments? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. In Susan Gravy's summary from the Oregon State Bar, she indicated that she anticipated that there would be no opposition, but was fairly certain that the Oregon Bankers Association would likely be supporters. And we don't see anyone here.
We have no other witnesses signed up, so apparently no one took a sufficient interest to come by to give us their comments.
And then just for clarification then, as I'm understanding this, it's eliminating a term general to give the trustee the discretion in limited areas as well as the broader context. Is that correct?
That's right.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah. After any further comments or questions, do I hear a motion on Senate Bill 305?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 305 to the floor of the due pass recommendation placed on the consent agenda.
Representative Wisnett has moved Senate Bill 305 to the floor with a due pass recommendation for placement on the consent calendar. Is there any further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Senate Bill 305 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation for placement of the consent calendar. I will now close the work session on Senate Bill 305 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 307. Councilor Kalmanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 307 allows a court to extend judgments for family support obligations before the judgment remedy is about to expire if the judgment provides for a future award of money. The bill makes some grammatical, non-substantive changes to several family law statutes. It also permits an award of attorney fees and costs in a custody modification proceeding. SB 307 allows that both parents and not just fathers, as it currently states in the bill, are entitled to relief from maintaining and educating a minor. And finally, SB 307 repeals ORS 106.210, which provides a remedy for illegitimacy resulting from certain repealed or unconstitutional laws that voided certain biracial marriages.
Okay, we have one witness signed up, Lauren Saucy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lauren Soce. I am an attorney in town. I'm actually an associate with the law firm of Paul Soce, PC, right here in town, Marion County, born and raised. I've been exclusively family law since I began my practice. I am here on behalf of the family law section of the Oregon State Bar. We're right around 1,100 members right now, so we are a fairly large section. And we are the sponsors of this bill. What you have before you in Senate Bill 307 is pretty much a couple years in the making. What we've done is we've solicited ideas from our members across the state to see where in our current laws that we use every day are there inconsistencies or maybe some outdated language that we need to clean up. And we took all those recommendations and we put them in front of a legislative subcommittee that was comprised of attorneys in private practice, legal aid, legislative counsel, court administrator's office, attorney general's office, and we asked them what they thought. And the seven changes you see before you in Senate Bill 307 are the ones that our committee was unanimous in supporting. So what I'd like to do is walk through these changes with you briefly. Be glad to entertain any questions as we go through or at the end. Section 1 amends ORS 18.180 to provide for a more consistent time frame for enforcement of remedies in a property division of a divorce case. There is a 10-year time frame which can be renewed for 10 years, which originally starts at the time the divorce was filed. This provides for the start of that time frame to begin when the first payment is due. A lot more frequently we're seeing cases where perhaps a husband owes a wife a $50,000 equalizing judgment to even out the property award, but it's not due until the child reaches age 18 or for 5 years from this date. So instead of starting the enforcement time frame of 10 years at the time the judgment is entered, we're saying, okay, when payment is due, then it's 10 years from that time frame. Just more consistency there. Section 2 clarifies some grammatically cumbersome language in ORS 107.015. Take a double negative out of the statute. Section 3 also contains some typographical changes, but it also clarifies that ORS 107.093, which is an automatic statutory restraining order provision, which goes into effect when a divorce case is filed, that says, okay, a divorce case has now been filed. Nobody should be making any changes on beneficiary designations of insurance or retirement. No extraordinary expenditures. What we're clarifying there is that that statutory restraining order is subject to the remedial contempt powers of the court. That is a fairly new statute. I think it was last session, and there has been some differences of opinion with courts throughout the state, and so we're clarifying that the court does indeed have remedial contempt power to enforce that statutory restraining order. Section 4 is, again, dealing with typographical changes in ORS 107.485. Those were suggested by Legislative Council. Section 5 allows attorneys to seek, or allows an award of attorney fees in modifications of Family Abuse Prevention Act restraining order proceedings. This is really just a complementary corollary to the fact that when you file an original Family Abuse Prevention Act restraining order case, there is a provision that authorizes attorney fees. So if there is in the original proceeding, we've picked up the language exactly to allow it in a modification. That was just an omission earlier. Section 6 deals with ORS 109.020. That statute relieves a party from the obligation to support a child that has income-producing property. The change we're making is allowing mothers instead of just fathers to also seek relief. So we change the word father to parent, make it gender neutral. Section 7 and 8 repeal ORS 106.210. That statute was a fix when we had on our books laws that said that biracial marriages were void. So that was a remedy that said children can be legitimized. We no longer need that statute, as that's no longer an issue. So if the problem isn't there, there's no need for the fixed statute. So those are the changes that we proposed under Senate Bill 307. I want to thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. Be glad to attempt to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Sosi. Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Krieger.
On page 3, line 7, ORS 33.055, remedial sanctions. What's all there?
I'm sorry, could you point me again? I missed
it. It's on page 3, line 7.
Page 3, line 7, and we're in section 3?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so the imposition of remedial sanctions, that's the clarification of the contempt power of the court. Remedial contempt versus criminal issues for violation of the statute, so the court can impose any provision that it thinks will remedy the situation in the future. It's just clarifying that there are already contempt powers of the court that are contemplated whenever you violate a restraining order provision entered by a judge who signed an order. This statute is creating problems in that it's an automatic provision that arises, so no judge looked at these two parties and says, hey, you can't make any extraordinary expenditures or change the beneficiaries. I'm ordering you, sir, not to do that. And so the courts have had problems saying, gee, I didn't sign an order that said that. Can I really enforce it? And so what this does is say, hey, the intent of the statute originally was to produce this automatic restraining order so we wouldn't have to look at every single case. We just know outright that people should not be doing these types of things when a divorce is filed. And so we're just tying in there the court's general power and contempt issues. I don't know if that answered your question.
Thank you, Jen.
Okay.
Any further questions? Representative Cameron.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Section 6, I'm just curious, and I understand the changing the father to the parent, but maybe just clarifying, this is used during a time when a minor has more expensive or the ability to pay for an education or something that the parents can't afford to pay for? Is that when this is invoked?
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, this allows a parent who is obligated to provide support for a child to petition the court in cases where the child may have more income-producing assets than does the parent. It's just, so yes, that's what it's invoked.
Thank you.
Representative Barker.
What kind of circumstance is that where grandma has left the kid a house or something? And
Representative McPherson, Representative Barker, yes. If there's some kind of trust or anything established for the benefit of the child where the child's grandparents are very common to say, hey, I'm going to make this trust and it's going to go to the grandchild to support their education, et cetera, et cetera. So in instances of those cases, yes.
Thank you. Any further questions? If not, then Ms. Sosi, why don't you stay in place there while I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 307 and open a work session on Senate Bill 307. Doesn't seem to present major policy issues in this bill, just a range of items that are to clean up and update various statutes affecting family law in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, would you think this would be suitable for the consent calendar with six changes? Or
I think it does, even though there are a number of changes. I don't think any one of these changes are ones that people would need a discussion on the floor, although if people feel otherwise.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I don't feel otherwise, but I just will express a comment that I heard from a colleague on the floor yesterday, and they were a couple of bills that did come out of our committee, and they felt that some of the items that we had put on the consent calendar, which I understand we had agreed here, might create some further discussion. They didn't have information upon, just because it was on the consent, that it was necessarily a good thing. So just we would consider that in the future as we move things to the consent calendar. Sometimes it's helpful to enhance the information that we provide to our colleagues for a vote.
I appreciate that comment, and I think our aim should be we should always tend toward a presentation on the bill if we think there's any need for it. I think the consent calendar should only be for those items that we think it would not raise controversy at all. And, you know, it could be that with the number of items here and the potential that some member on the floor might think that any one of those might, you know, generate further interest or concern, perhaps it means that this bill would be appropriate for to have a carrier.
Chair McPherson, I would go in that direction because all these things, having been a person that's walked through this path and had a child that's also walked through this path, there's some clarifying information here that maybe a number of colleagues would find helpful when their constituents call saying, you know, when I shared with several people that we were working on child support bills that possibly will have an impact, I mean, their interest was high. With six changes, I don't know. And I will certainly support the will of the committee, but
This
is not simple stuff.
And that's a useful discussion. Do I hear a motion on the Senate bill?
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 307 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and at your determination as to whether it would go on to the consent calendar.
I think we'll take that as a motion, from Representative Flores, to move Senate Bill 307 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I think we'll leave off that consideration of how it ought to be presented on the floor. Is there a discussion of the motion on the bill? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Trump.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. Senate Bill 307 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I think I think we should, if there's any thought that we should have a presentation on the bill, I think we should do that rather than having on the consent calendar. So that would since you had raised the point, Representative Flores, would you be willing to be the carrier?
I would be delighted.
That's wonderful. And I do recall that in my first session in the legislature, serving on this committee chaired by Max Williams, he took the position that either there should be no bills on the consent placed on the consent calendar from the Judiciary Committee, or very sparingly, I can't remember, was one or the other of those positions, on the theory that everything we are doing is changing the laws of Oregon, and that in itself is a sufficient basis for a presentation. So I think a lot of us presented bills that seemed pretty limited in their scope from the Judiciary Committee that session. We've tended to go a little different direction this time, but I think it's certainly, if there's any sense that we should have a fuller presentation, I think that we ought to aim that direction.
And once again, Mr. Chair, I bring that up only as advisory and expressing the concern that I did have, or comment that I did have yesterday, and that we would consider that. So I appreciate your consideration, not suggesting that we completely veer away, but I know that as much information as possible would be helpful, not only to our constituents, but to our colleagues who have to press that button.
Right. Good comments. We have moved this bill out. So I will close the work session on Senate Bill 307 That concludes our agenda, members. Thank you very much for your attendance. We are adjourned.